Welcome to the 119th episode of Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that wonderful moment when you can high-five the person next to you and shout, "Yes, I'm in." Now, are you a pre-med and wondering, what are you really going to learn in medical school? Or maybe you're a resident and would like to do a quick review of a few topics that you studied but don't remember as well as you would like. Where should you turn? Well, you might turn to YouTube, and if you're lucky, you'll find yourself at the YouTube channel of Dr. Eric Strong, Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine at the Stanford School of Medicine. His channel has almost 59,000 subscribers, and a quick perusal of some of his videos show one on how to interpret a chest x-ray with 132,000 plus downloads, and another one on heart murmurs with, at the time that I checked, 261,588 downloads. Many others have in the tens of thousands of downloads. So who is the producer of these videos? Eric Strong earned his bachelor's at MIT and his medical degree at NYU. He interned and did his residency at Stanford and then joined the faculty at Stanford Medical. I watched a couple of the videos and they are really clear and easy to follow. So let's meet the Steven Spielberg of medical educational videos, Dr. Eric Strong. Eric, I'm delighted you could join me today.
Well, thank you very much, Linda, for inviting me.
You're very welcome. What's the story behind your YouTube channel?
It actually started about 4 years ago. I was, as a lot of Stanford faculty are requested to do if they have time, I was giving some lectures to the medicine residents at noon conference every day. I don't lecture every day, but they have a lecture every day, and I gave a couple of these over the course of the year. And the program asked whether or not the individual lecturers could actually make their PowerPoint slides available online so that anyone that was off that day or sick or had clinical duties that prevented them from attending, you know, they could kind of look at the PowerPoint slides and see what they had missed. And when I saw that request, I thought, well, that's kind of nice. I mean, they want to make sure people don't miss education opportunities. But at the same time, if your PowerPoint slides in isolation can act as an adequate substitute for the lecture, that's a big problem. So I decided to actually kind of incrementally make it a little bit better by actually recording narration to the PowerPoint slides. And then at the time, that file was so large that there actually was literally no place that the residency program had to store it where residents could log in and download it. So I just thought, hey, well, YouTube's, you know, everyone knows YouTube. It's very easy to navigate. It's very accessible. Let me just post it on YouTube. And you know, I call it Eric's Medical Lectures just because, to be honest, that way the residents could find it really easily if they wanted to see it. Oh, well, I heard Eric, you know, talked about COPD last week or whatnot. But as soon as it's on YouTube, of course, it's open to the world. Everyone can see it. And so people, you know, not affiliated with Stanford, you know, started finding these videos through just, you know, usual YouTube searches and started leaving comments and started sending me messages. And I was like, wow, this actually has a lot of potential to reach a lot more people than I was originally thinking about. And then from there, just the videos really kind of took off, became more numerous. I started diving into more complex topics and started, you know, making the videos themselves a little bit more involved with, you know, animation and stuff like that. But it kind of had very, very humble, very simple beginnings.
A neighbor and good friend of ours is Dr. Fink, or Professor Fink, and he also has a very active YouTube channel. I think he teaches nursing in a local community college, but I think it started very similarly. And, you know, just had some things he thought his students could benefit from. Also, I mean, many, many, many downloads. I don't know the exact numbers.
Yeah, no, I think it's actually really common in the YouTube educator community where a lot of people that have, you know, much more popular channels than I do, a lot of them just totally stumbled into it. You know, when they first started posting videos, they had no idea what their plan was. They didn't have like this grand scheme in mind. They just got started doing it and just kind of took off and developed a life of its own.
Right. My daughter, when she was 19, was studying business. We were at somebody's house for dinner, and my daughter just started popping up and says, "You know, Mom, you did it all wrong with your business." And my business was quite successful. Thank you. "You did it all wrong." She said, what do you mean I did wrong? Well, she just started taking business classes, and in her business classes, she had learned that you have to have a business plan, and I didn't have a business plan. So she was telling me that I was doing it all wrong, to which our host responded. He said, "Your mom has a successful, profitable, growing business. What is she doing wrong? She must be doing something right." But sometimes you don't even need a grand plan. It works out. Now, Stanford Medical is leading the way in an interactive, high-tech approach to medical education. I mean, its flipped classroom is very prominent on the website. Which came first in kind of the evolution of your channel, Stanford's focus on an engaged and flipped classroom, or you're kind of experimenting and helping out the residents who could not attend your lunchtime lectures?
They actually kind of happened around the same time. They really developed, I think, largely in parallel. You know, for the first 1 or 2 years, I think most of the faculty was really kind of unaware of what I was doing on YouTube. And like I said, it started off really small, so I wouldn't have expected anyone to have noticed. And I was actually largely unaware of like, some of the flipped classroom material that other people were working on, which for the most part is in the medical school and not the residency program. And because we're kind of working in parallel, I'm not sure if initially we really influenced each other too much. I think one of the major problems that materials that schools and universities have when they create these material for themselves is, you know, the materials can be phenomenal, it can be great, it can be a lot of thought and time and effort and money and production quality put into it.
Right.
But they often live behind a firewall. So, for example, you know, by all accounts, our school's biochemistry course has this amazing collection of video material that perfectly complements these engaging in-class activities that they have, and it's really like people hold it up as this epitome of what the flipped classroom can do. But even though I'm at the same institution, I because I don't teach in the biochem course, I've never seen any of it.
Really?
And I would love to see it, but I just don't have access to it. Having said that, you know, it's certainly nice to hear that other faculty at Stanford are passionate about flipped classrooms, and you know, certainly we share and talk about our experiences and share ideas. But I think, to be honest, a lot of us have not necessarily seen each other's material, which is, I think, a great shame.
Have you monetized your channel or not yet? Or is it just something you're doing as a hobby?
That's a great question, actually.
Yeah.
It's actually come up very recently. I have not monetized my channel. It was sort of a very intentional decision, actually. Early on, it was a combination of the fact that the ads on YouTube videos are, you know, you sort of learn to block them out eventually, but at first they're a little bit distracting.
Yeah.
And second, I kind of assumed that, how many people are actually going to click on these ads? Is it actually going to make a lot of money?
Mm-hmm.
And then actually just a couple weeks ago, I was attending this conference down in Anaheim called VidCom, which is sort of like, I think some people translate it as a YouTube conference.
Mm-hmm.
They had a separate section of the conference that was for content creators. And actually, I hooked up with a whole bunch of people that make educational videos on YouTube, you know, very similar to my own, and everyone has their own style. And they all thought I was crazy for not monetizing it. And they're like, what are you talking about? Like, why would you not monetize it? And I said, well, I don't see it making that much money. And one guy at our dinner table was like, no, you don't understand. Like, I thought the same thing. And then someone told me I needed to monetize. And then I monetized it. And then within a year, I bought myself a new car with that money.
Oh, wow.
And then other people have, you know, I've also known people that have actually retired from their initial teaching career and now only, like, they make a living from making YouTube videos and engaging people in social media. And through advertising revenue, that's sufficient to sustain that model for them. Now, I certainly have no intention of retiring from being a doctor, at least not for many decades. But it's certainly something I'm starting to reconsider when people have pointed out that, again, every person I know that has a monetized channel finds out I don't monetize, they all think I'm crazy.
Well, I think I mentioned to you our friend a minute ago, also, at least last I checked with him, was not monetizing it. And another neighbor and friend was absolutely furious with him. He was like, you are crazy. You're throwing money out. What are you doing? It was like, if you want to push the second neighbor's button, just start on this. Oh, he goes to town. But
yeah, I will say, you know, it's not just, and you know, you talk to other YouTube educators, you know, they'll say the same thing. It's not just about making money to buy new cars. It's also, you know, if you start getting revenue, then that increases the amount of money and resources you can put into making videos.
Sure.
You know, for example, you know, people that I talk to, you know, they say, oh, well, I used to just record myself drawing on a whiteboard, but I know it was like super low tech, started getting some money, and then I actually got enough money that I could actually hire out animators that can come in and like actually animate things that I can use in future videos, or allowed me to buy a nicer camera or better lighting equipment or this or that. And so the money actually kind of then feeds back into being able to create actually better, even more engaging videos. So there's multiple benefits to monetization.
Right, right. You mentioned a minute ago social media, and your bio page says that one of your research interests is social media in medical education. Other than YouTube, are you engaging with other social media? Are you using other social media?
about a year ago or maybe a year and a half ago, I started using Twitter. For a long time, I'd been kind of avoiding Twitter because I wasn't convinced that it was actually a helpful platform for, you know, serious discussion. And I think it still has, you know, its drawbacks, certainly. But someone convinced me, someone in medical education who was very, very, very involved on Twitter, convinced me to give it a try. And I've gotten a little bit more into it. I follow a number of people on the platform and share ideas and links and whatnot. So I've started to get more into Twitter. As far as other social media, like things like Facebook, I just, at least in medical education, I've been unconvinced that Facebook has, to be honest, any obvious value. at least not yet. I mean, maybe someday it'll take off. I don't know. It seems like Facebook's maybe on the decline, actually, at this point. But, you know, Twitter, I think, definitely has some value to it, and I use it intermittently.
What is the value of medical education of the social media in your perspective, from your perspective?
Well, I think one of the major benefits is it allows conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're learning from a textbook, you know, no matter how well the textbook is written, no matter how important the information is, no matter how beautiful the pictures are, you can't talk to the author. You can't ask questions. You can't point out mistakes. You can't have any kind of two-way dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's a static book. But when a person posts something on the internet, whether it's a 140-character tweet or an hour-long video on YouTube, any other person in the world who encounters that post, they can send a message either publicly or privately, and they can ask about it. They can disagree with it. They can ask questions. They can pass it along to others. And that's something I think is really powerful about social media, about the use of social media in medicine, that other forms of learning, you know, textbooks being probably the other extreme, just don't have. I think another benefit about social media is that it gives this huge voice to thoughtful people who otherwise might get drowned out by the noise. You know, for now, this effect is largely confined, I think, to emergency medicine and critical care fields, where Twitter and blogs have really taken off probably more so than other medical fields.
Really?
But there's a handful of relatively young faculty and even house staff in EM and critical care that have developed significant influence through blog posts and their Twitter accounts. Huh. And they use this influence actually, you know, they share novel ideas, they call attention to important papers that otherwise may have flown under the radar. And these are people that are young enough in their career trajectory that if they were relying solely on talking at meetings or relying solely on publication and more kind of quote scholarly endeavors, they may not have get the attention that their thoughts and their ideas deserve. But you know, they get a Twitter account, or they get a blog, or get a YouTube channel, and it's sort of like you don't need to be established for 30 years for people to subscribe to your Twitter account, like you might have to in order to speak at some major conference. I mean, you can, right, if you have a great idea and people like your idea, they will find it and they'll share it with other people, and it will you know, go viral, you know, just like other things on social media. It's the same way in med ed. So I think it's a great opportunity to give a voice to people that really may, again, have been drowned out by the noise in other media.
It's almost a democratizing of influence.
Yeah, no, it definitely is.
Look, I've been blogging, I think, almost 10 years now, and I've been on Twitter probably 4 or 5 years, less active on YouTube, though we want to pick that up a little bit. And obviously now I have this podcast. So I certainly, and I really appreciate the ability to have a dialogue. Like, we have a very active commenting on our blog. So I fully appreciate that. But there's just so much garbage, so much noise. Yeah. That's also part of social media that, yeah, you know, when you talk about it almost acting as a filter for quality, I have to express a certain skepticism sometimes. So it can have, I think, both impacts, but it's wonderful that, I guess, in specific niches, it is turning into a very positive force.
I think you see that. I definitely see that on my YouTube channel, you know, where if you go to a YouTube channel that's about, you know, general health information for lay people,
right,
you know, where anyone can log in and they can just be like, oh, I want to see a 2-minute video on what heart failure is. And again, it's aimed solely at lay people. It's very non-technical. Those, you know, the comment section of a channel like that, it's. I mean, there's some gems in there. There's some great questions in there, but they'll be filled with all kinds of
nonsense.
You know, kind of nonsense. Yeah, I mean, for lack of a better word,
That's pretty polite, actually.
But a YouTube channel, I find that a YouTube channel that is aimed at medical professionals, where the videos are very technical, they're more advanced, they require medical training to even understand them. The comment sections of those channels are way more engaging, way more thoughtful. You know, I get very little spam and very little nonsense in my comment section because, to be honest, people that would leave nonsense, they come to my channel and they immediately realize this is not interesting for me. This is not what I'm looking for. And they immediately leave. And the people that come to my channel and stay engaged and watch videos and leave comments, they're the ones that are there because they want to have a high-level discussion. They want to have a high-level dialogue. They want to learn something pretty advanced. And you see that not just on YouTube. You see that also on Twitter accounts, Twitter feeds of some of these people I'm talking about, again, that are pretty influential on Twitter. Their follower list is not, just random selection of people in the community. Like, the follower list is, medical trainees, even medical professionals in their own fields. And so, again, I think the discussion that goes back and forth, even within the 140 character limit, which drives me crazy, the discussion is pretty advanced and is pretty interesting and important.
Right. I listened to your May 2015 update, and you mentioned there are two milestones for your channel. The first one was 50,000 plus subscribers, and obviously in the last 3 months it's soared even more because I think I saw 58 or 59,000 when I was on there. And the other part was that you could no longer respond to each and every comment and email you received. So obviously up until that point, you were responding to each and every one or almost each and every one. And you clearly, from your comments here, you obviously enjoy that dialogue.
Absolutely.
Is there an email or comment that really stands out in your mind? Some exchange that really stands out in your mind?
I don't know if there's an individual specific exchange that stands out more than the others. I think, maybe one type of email that I really enjoy particularly getting is actually from other educators. When they send me a message and they say that they've adopted my videos for their own courses as part of a flipped classroom or other blended model that they're using themselves at their institution. I love getting them. I mean, that's great. I really enjoy reading those messages and finding out how other people are using the videos in their own classroom. That to me is super rewarding because, I mean, that's why I'm doing this. I'm it's not just to put videos online for individual people. It's also because I recognize that it takes a lot of time to do this and to have, 100 different people across the country or across the world all making videos in the exact same topic is for their classroom is really just a complete waste of effort. And so if I can put them on YouTube and other people, instead of, again, duplicating effort, they can just use my videos, and then that gives them more time for developing in-class activities, the other part of actually the more important part of the flipped classroom. To me, that's great. That's one of the reasons I'm doing this. So I love getting those emails to find out, again, how people are using the material themselves.
That's great. Now, what's your favorite video or series of video on your channel? Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I don't know if I have. I have this top 10 playlist where
I saw that.
Listed my top 10 favorite videos. I don't know if one stands out particularly above the others. I mean, I do like the video series on chest X-rays, ECGs, and ABGs, which I sort of cop out because that's like encompasses like 50 videos right there. But I like it. I like those. I think I feel the most proud of those because I really think that they will take a learner who knows nothing about learning about chest X-rays or nothing about EKGs, and it takes them through in kind of an organized, logical fashion from the very, very beginning all the way up through the most advanced thing that they'll ever need to know as a practicing clinician. And the reason I'm proud of those is because I don't know if there's other resources out there that will do the same thing, where, again, will take you from the very, very, very beginning of the topic and teach you all the way through in a continuous logical sequence, take you all the way through to what you need to know as an attending physician. So I put a lot of time into those series, and I'm pretty proud of those.
I watched the first two from the chest X-ray, and I have a terrible background in science. So, I can't say I understood every minute, but I could follow it. And as I mentioned earlier, they were very, very clear. How do you choose which videos to make?
At this point, they're actually all based on viewer requests. Really? I get, to be honest, two or three requests every day for different topics. And when people request them, I sort of put them into different categories, put them on the short list and a long list or the probably not going to get to list. And determining which ones go on the short list, meaning the ones I'm going to do in the next handful of months, what it kind of depends on a couple of things. It sort of depends on how much of an authority I feel on that topic. You know, if they ask me, if they suggest a topic that I actually feel really, you know, good about and something I use a lot and something that I don't actually need to do that much research on my own to do, you know, that gets a higher priority. I also think about which topics have a lack of good resources out there already. So, for example, I've gotten lots of requests for biochemistry videos, and I love biochemistry. There's actually a lot of, like, high-quality biochemistry material already available, and I feel like, you know, spending, you know, a lot of time, spending 100 hours to create a series on biochemistry would sort of, I don't want to say, like, wasted effort, but it's a time that would probably be spent doing something else that really doesn't have a good resource right now. Lastly, I think about things like what takes the most time, because, you know, some topics that people have asked about, topics in anatomy, for example.
Yeah.
And anatomy also, to be honest, has a lot of great resources already. But even if it didn't, anatomy is very, very visual. It's very image intensive. And that just, it takes a lot more time to create a good and a high quality anatomy video, assuming you're not going to, you know, plagiarize images from Netter. It's going to take a lot more time to create a high quality video than creating a video on EKG reading, which, you know, still can be very visual, but just it's much, much faster to create good EKG images than it is to create good anatomy images. So that also plays a little bit into the decision-making process.
Do you create your own images, or do you have somebody helping you with that?
No. So 100% of the image, I don't say 100 because I'm sure there's probably something that's snuck through the editing process, but 99.9% of the videos are my own content or things from the public domain.
Uh-huh.
And majority of those are actually my own images that I create. I haven't monetized my videos yet. Had the funds to hire someone outside, but I know that may be coming along in the future.
Again, I mentioned that I watched a couple of the chest X-ray videos, and my science background is A, from a long time ago, and B, as weak as I could make it at the time. And I found your videos to be just incredibly, incredibly clear, and the visuals to be engaging. What are you doing that makes them so clear, even to one who could be politely called a novice and more accurately called an ignoramus? But I mean, it was really amazing.
I suspect you're underselling yourself. But,
no. No.
Well, I sort of approached the videos with two principles. The first one's going to sound totally cliche, but it's true. I assume the viewer is motivated, self-motivated. They are intelligent, but they know absolutely nothing about the topic I'm discussing.
Okay.
So, you know, you start from the very beginning, but you don't talk down to people. You know, you assume your viewer is intelligent, but you start from scratch. The second principle is that I try to structure the videos such that the focus is on high-yield figures, which are then connected to one another by so-called text slides, as opposed to what I think a lot of other people do, which is to focus on dense text slides, and then kind of occasionally interrupt them with occasional pictures.
Uh-huh.
So I really, when I sit down to create a new video, I don't think about, you know, first of all, I think about the learning objectives. After learning objectives, then I think about the figures and the images and the animations, because those are what's going to keep people's attention. Those are what are going to catch people's attention and keep people's attention. And then, again, there's obviously a lot of text that I include. You know, I include a lot of text because a lot of the viewers are not from the United States. They're from other countries, and English may be their second, third, or even fourth language. So I want to try to make it as understandable as possible for those individuals. But at the same time, the text is secondary. The images are really primary.
Right. So, I mean, like the couple of videos that I watched on the chest X-ray, I could imagine somebody who let's say, is in medical school, and they did the section on, I don't know, pulmonary medicine or whatever they would be studying, and now they're on the floor, their third year, and all of a sudden it's like, well, how do I read a chest X-ray? I can imagine that they would really – is that whom you were gearing it towards?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, it's sort of – you know, different videos have slightly different audiences in mind. I mean, yeah. The general audience is, you know, across the board is, you know, people who are healthcare professionals and healthcare trainees.
Mm-hmm.
But within that, different videos are targeting different people. So, for example, the chest x-ray video is targeting that exact person you just described, someone that just finished their first 2 years of med school, but now on the wards in the hospital, and they just realize, like, oh my gosh, I do not know how to look at a chest x-ray. That mm-hmm. series is exactly for that person. Other videos are for, like, for example, I have a series of videos, or the beginning of a series of videos on advanced EKG reading. That is not for the third-year medical student. Third-year medical students are going to get totally lost if they start looking at that. That's for, you know, the senior medicine residents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have videos for MCAT, for students studying for the MCATs who are still in college.
That's going to be my next question.
Okay. So, you know, it depends on the topic.
All right. As I said, that is going to be my next question. We have many pre-meds among our listeners. Which videos are geared towards MCAT prep?
Yeah, so I think the clearest example of videos for MCAT prep is I have this 12-part series on fluid mechanics, and I can't quote the exact MCAT section off the top of my head, but it is for a specific MCAT. I'm going to say the 4C or something like that. And each video in this series is about 10 minutes. It consists of four parts. It starts with a conceptual introduction to some topic in fluid mechanics, such as like hydrostatic pressure or the Bernoulli effect or turbulence. Then I discuss the mathematical equation that's related to that topic. And then give a classic example of the topics, like something you might encounter in an introductory physics textbook.
Mm-hmm.
And then last, I give a real-world example of how the concept is applied in medicine, usually in an application that I actually use in routine practice in the hospital, sometimes on a daily basis. So, for example, I'll talk about hydrostatic pressure, and I'll talk about how that's used to estimate the jugular venous pressure or the central venous pressure, right, in the heart by looking at the dilation of the internal jugular vein in the neck, which actually just works. It just works on the principle of hydrostatic pressure. I also talk about, again, with turbulence and Reynolds numbers as the equation that sort of describes turbulence in a very basic sense or describes how to determine whether or not fluid flow will be turbulent. And I link that to heart murmurs, you know, in the sense that, you know, what determines whether or not someone has a heart murmur is based exactly on the principles of what goes into the Reynolds number. For example, what's the viscosity of the blood? What's the velocity of the blood? What's the cross-sectional area of the valve that the blood is traveling through? And trying to link, again, the classic high school physics and college physics concepts to something that's applicable in medicine to make students realize that, hey, just this stuff isn't just for the MCATs. This is actually information that's going to help me later on. I think a lot of people don't realize, like, when they're studying for the MCATs, they think, oh my gosh, like, why in the world do I have to learn about fluid mechanics?
Sure.
Like, how's this ever going to come up? Like, why, like, Bernoulli principle, really, in medicine? Like, Bernoulli is like what keeps airplanes in the sky. How's that relate to the human body? But in fact, actually, Bernoulli is used in medicine all the time. And I think making that connection will help students not just understand it in the moment, but help students realize that, hey, this is important. I gotta learn this not just for the MCATs, but I gotta learn this for my future career.
That's great. Now, as a Stanford Medical School professor, I'm gonna switch topics here a little bit.
Sure.
What skills or traits do you feel pre-meds should develop in themselves if they want to be a successful medical student and ultimately a great physician?
The common answer is something like, oh, they have to have great study skills, or they have to be a great listener, or they have to be really compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
And all those things are definitely true. I don't mean to downplay the importance of those things. But I think the skill or the trait is probably a better word for it, that people underappreciate is the value of curiosity. Having amazing study skills, being great at memorization, having good communication skills, those things are all necessary for being a successful doctor. But the doctors that I see and encounter and the students that I see and encounter that are really like the ones that stand out far and above everyone else, they're the ones that are not only very bright, not only great communicators with patients, but they're the ones that are also curious about the world around them, about what they're seeing. So, and how that kind of applies in day-to-day practice, you can imagine a patient coming into the hospital, into the emergency department, for example, with shortness of breath, and you go down there and see them. The outstanding physician who's not curious, but still outstanding, might say, all right, well, this patient has shortness of breath. These are the five most common causes of shortness of breath. This person seems like fits mostly into this one cause. It most closely falls into to heart failure because of X, Y, and Z. So let me go ahead and treat the patient for heart failure and see how they do. And that's, I think that's sort of how a lot of physicians practice, and the kind of mentality, again, a smart, bright physician, competent, not curious, kind of just defaults to one of a small handful of diagnoses. But when I see, what really impresses me is when a student or a resident sees a patient with shortness of breath and says, you know what, these are the five most common causes of shortness of breath, but this is one aspect of the patient's case that just, it doesn't fit with any of these five. It just, it stands out, it's not the predominant feature, and it's something that a lot of people would gloss over, but I'm kind of bothered by why this lab test is this, or why the chest X-ray looks like that. Let me look into that a lot more, and let me do some research on that. Let me do more physical exam findings, or look for more physical exam findings to better clarify that, and kind of go through that process. Maybe they come out and say, you know what, I think this patient doesn't have one of the five most common causes of shortness of breath. I think this patient actually has some relatively rare and serious disease that we can actually treat, but we need to identify and we need to kind of go down that diagnostic pathway. So again, it's about curiosity. That's, you know, if the doctor that's not curious can treat, you know, 95% of people without a problem, but if you want to treat the 5% of patients that come in with something less common or a very unusual presentation of something, you need curiosity for that extra 5%. And that, I think this principle doesn't apply just in clinical medicine. I think it also applies in research, probably potentially even more so, that right. You know, the researcher that's not curious, I mean, I don't understand how they could be a successful researcher if you're not wanting to answer questions that no one else has answered before.
Or even pose the questions.
Or pose the questions, exactly. So that's a really important skill, I think, or trait, sorry.
Okay. What qualities do you think are particularly important at Stanford Medicals? Specifically at Stanford.
Qualities, you know, to be a Stanford student, for example?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't mean the obvious good grades and high MCAT score. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking that you know, is assumed. But there are going to be people with high test scores and grades who don't get into Stanford, and there's some that do get into Stanford. Do you see any kind of common thread among your students at Stanford?
Yeah, so the common thread is that every student stands out.
Okay.
And that sounds kind of silly, perhaps, but
paradoxical.
You know, I think when I was in med school, I sort of just assumed that, hey, an undergraduate, I just thought, hey, you know, I'm going to a great college, a great university. I'm getting decent grades. All I have to do is get good MCAT scores, and that'll be sufficient to get into med school. And I don't need to worry about anything else. And what you realize, and I started to realize this when I was on interviews and started to talk to other people, you realize that, like, wow, everyone around me, they all went to great schools, they all got good grades, and I'm just guessing that they all got really high MCAT scores. You start getting really nervous that you don't stand out. Like, you're just one of thousands of applicants to that school.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I look at people at Stanford, the students I teach at Stanford now, every single one of them has done something that makes them unique, beyond just the usual good grades, and beyond just, you know, research is great, and depending what field you want to eventually go into, research may be essential, but research is not going to be enough to make you stand out. You know, unless you have that first author paper in Nature, you know, just working in a lab for a few summers, that is not going to be enough to stand out. You know, volunteering at a soup kitchen, you know, every other Saturday afternoon, that's not going to be enough to stand out. You really need to do something very unique, and I use this as an example. I actually talked about this in one of my videos on giving advice to pre-meds. And I talk about the fact that when I applied to medical school, I had, you know, 15 or maybe even 20 different extracurricular activities. You know, everything from, like, you know, secretary for the Habitat Humanity Club. I was in musical theater. I volunteered. I tutored at a local elementary school, and had this, you know, great list of, like, really, like, broad, diverse, humanistic type of extracurricular activities. And when I interviewed for all my medical schools, all my medical school interviews, I was not asked a single question about any of those activities.
Really?
And the reason was, this is a hypothesis, I don't actually know, but I suspect the reason was just because none of them stood out. They all were just like, oh, okay, another guy that does, you know, Circle K, or another guy that volunteers at an elementary school, another guy that, you know, tutored, you know, organic chemistry. But when I was in medical school, I actually took a year off from med school, and my wife and I, we went to work at a hospital in Papua New Guinea, and we did this research project there on domestic violence among local women.
Wow.
And when we applied to residency program, every single residency interview asked about that experience. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because it was like this amazing, you know, world-changing experience, because to be honest, I probably had more impact volunteering at a local elementary school than I did working at a hospital where I didn't have any idea what world I was doing. But it was because it stood out. It was something that was unique, and that when it comes time to come up with the rank list or time to send out acceptance notices, and the admissions committee is sitting around a table, and they're kind of debating, like, do we accept this student and that student? They're not going to remember the student that has good grades and good MCAT scores, because that's just everyone else.
Yeah.
But if you do something unique, like if you started, you know, your own NGO, or you wrote a book, or you, you know, did Teach for America, or you did something that was, that, again, it doesn't have to be world-changing. Doesn't have to take years of your life.
Do they have to climb Mount Everest?
No, you don't have to climb Mount Everest. just do something that makes you stand out, and that makes people be able to remember you. Like, oh, you know, I can remember encountering one person much earlier in training who had taken 6 months off from their life and had driven around the country on a motorcycle to see small town America. And they talked about that, I think, in the context of their application. Like something like that has nothing to do with medicine per se.
Right.
But again, it was this initial, it was a really interesting life experience that, again, made them stand out and I think left an impression with the interviewers. And so if students, I mean, when we look at Stanford medical students, I have to be honest, almost every single Stanford medical student has something in this type of genre that, again, sets them apart from the other thousands of people that applied that did not get accepted.
Right. Yeah. I think, some of the advice that, you know, I typically give to applicants is to, on one hand, show that you're going to fit in, which is largely done via grades and test scores, and that you did the research and you did the classic kind of clinical exposure, but then also show how you're going to stand out and contribute something distinctive to the classroom discussion, to the class community.
Hmm. So, something related to that, I think, is having a unique voice. Having a unique perspective, mm-hmm. Within the confines of not being so extreme to be disruptive, which, you know, I suppose might happen once in a while, but medical schools do not want 100 students that look the same.
Right.
They want a diversity, not just because they can, you know, put it on some application and make, or some pamphlet and make themselves look better. But they want diversity because diversity actually improves the quality of education of the peers, of the people around you. You know, they want to hear alternate viewpoints. They want to hear different perspectives. They want every student to bring something unique to the school. And so that's definitely something that's also very, very valued.
Right. What's the question you wish I would have asked you?
What's next? You know, what's next in YouTube channel?
Okay. That's a good one.
So, you know, right now, I've been, like I mentioned earlier, I attended this conference, this VidCon, a few weeks ago, and I met with lots of other educators that teach online and create video content and kind of looking at different styles that they've been working on. Every educator online, you know, develops their own, like, visual and structural style that they adopt for all their videos. I sort of decided to actually play around a little bit with the formats. So, you know, right now it's sort of, you know, the basic Eric's Medical Lectures video sort of seems like it's an adapted noon conference that you might see, like, on the medicine wards, or an adapted med school lecture where, you know, take a 60-minute lecture and you kind of condense it down to 15 or 20 minutes of the high-yield information, throw some, you know, centered around, again, the pictures and the animations. But what I think I'm actually going to try is actually creating some videos that are much more compact, are sort of even briefer, that dive into one topic that's something that's very important that people may not think about and you may not otherwise hear about in your typical education.
Can you give an example?
So one example, maybe two examples that I'm working on right now. One is why we call it an ECG and why other people call it an EKG.
Mm-hmm.
Why is there a distinction? Where that distinction came from? Is one camp right and the other one wrong? You know, are there geographic differences? Are there differences between specialties? Because that's something that I've always kind of wondered about. Like, why is it that, like, you know, this person says ECG, this person says EKG, or that textbook says ECG or EKG, and patients come in, patients are confused by it sometimes. So, like,
sure.
What is an ECG? I got an EKG last week. Is that the same thing? And like, oh, that's the same thing. So that's one topic. Another topic is actually the first one I'm going to work on, or the first one I'm going to put out, is talking about what a normal heart rate is. There is this very prevalent myth, it's one of the most pervasive myths, I think, in all of medicine, that a normal heart rate is 60 to 100. And this 60 to 100 beats per minute, and it's like in almost every medical textbook, EKG machines are calibrated to read that as the normal rate. It's taught in every medical school and every medical course that 60 to 100 is normal. But if you actually look at the primary literature, 60 to 100 should not be considered normal. It is not the normal range, and we have all been misled by a century of false medical education.
So what is the normal range?
So the normal range, I mean, it depends a lot on who you are. But if you had to adopt a single range that would apply to the most number of adults, it actually would be 50 to 90, I think. That would be a much more appropriate rate than 60 to 100. And even 50 to 90 is a little bit debatable because, 50 to 90, if you take like 20,000 presumably healthy adults and you measure their resting heart rate, you'll see a relatively natural Gaussian distribution. It's not perfect, but a relatively Gaussian distribution within 50 to 90. But then if you follow those patients over a long period of time, the people at the upper range, the upper end of that range, probably end up having more heart disease, more strokes, more other vascular problems later in life, implying that even if 50 to 90 is the normal range in terms of that's where most people fall into, you still don't want to be on the upper end of that normal range. You still want to be on the lower end of the normal range, which kind of raises the question about what are we even talking about when we say normal? Are we saying normal is the typical patient, or are we saying normal is healthy?
Yeah.
Because as with many things in medicine, heart rate certainly not the only one, what's normal and what's healthy is by no means the same thing.
Right. That makes sense. So have you like looked at your stats and seen that shorter videos get more downloads or have a longer, a higher completion rate? Is that why you want to shorten the videos or just assuming that we're in a soundbite world?
Yeah, that's a great question. YouTube is one of the other things that's great about YouTube is that it's amazing analytical tools, and you can actually look to see, how long people watch your videos for.
Sure.
And ironically, my longer videos are not any less popular than my shorter videos.
Because that's what we've seen.
Yeah, no, it's commonly taught. When you go to workshops on how to create flipped classrooms and how to make successful video content, I mean, a lot of people focus on the length issue. They say it can't be more than 10 minutes, or it can't be more than 12 minutes, or you can't have more than one learning objective per video. I know that Khan Academy, for example, is very clear on only one learning objective per video. But at least in my own experience, looking at my own videos, there's almost zero correlation between length of video and views, or length of video and overall retention of audience retention.
Mm-hmm.
So the desire to make shorter videos isn't about necessarily increasing retention rates. It's more just about trying something different, maybe bringing in additional audience, additional viewers that aren't necessarily as interested in the technical aspects of medicine. They're not necessarily interested in the intricacies of how do you diagnose a heart attack from this EKG waveform, but they might be interested in a more broader, kind of a little bit more layperson discussion of why we call it an EKG versus an ECG, or what is a normal heart rate? People that's, they have a heart rate of 55 and we're worried it's too slow and, finding out actually 55 is totally normal. might kind of broaden the audience just a little bit.
Okay. Eric, this has been fascinating. I really enjoyed it, but I think it's time to bring this show to a close. Where can listeners learn more about your work?
Well, the most obvious place is just to go to the YouTube channel and check it out.
Okay.
You just go to YouTube. I don't know if you're going to have a URL, but you can just go to YouTube, and if you just type in my name under the YouTube search box, either Eric Strong, or you can type in Eric's Medical Lectures. Either one of those will bring you very quickly to my channel. You can see all the videos I have up there. People are more than welcome to send me messages through YouTube. I also have my email address there. If people have questions, people have suggestions or comments, absolutely please send them to me. I will do my best to answer as many of them as I possibly can. As you indicated, I no longer can answer every single comment I get, but anyone that seems directed from this podcast, I will make every effort to respond and get back to them.
Thank you. And we'll include links to the link to Eric's channel in the show notes at info.exhibit.com/119. That's 119. So you don't even have to use the search box. Okay. And again, thank you so much, Eric, for joining us. Listeners, thank you too for joining us for this, our 119th episode. I have a favor to ask. If you found this show helpful, could you leave your feedback on iTunes? It helps us get ranked more highly if there are more reviews, especially when they are glittering 5-star reviews. But you don't have to leave 5 stars if you don't think we deserve it. And if you're not yet a subscriber, you can subscribe either through iTunes, Stitcher, or Zoom. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.